There we go. That's a new thing. It had the logo for a second on the live stream before, like it had us. Well, that's exciting. Okay, I guess we'll get started. Blah 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 blah. For anybody who watches the live stream, which have been a few scattered views lately, I still have the something went wrong monkey on the thing that like supposed to show me comments. I don't know why. I don't really care because we don't really watch comments like during the live stream, really, usually, sometimes, maybe. But as long as I have the something went wrong monkey, I'm not. And I did just check like the last four or five episodes, no new comments on anything. So that's cool. The podcast really isn't about YouTube. It's just like an add-on to just like, it was one extra click, so we figured why not. And it gives me yet another backup in case something goes wrong with the other ways. I save the stuff for later for editing and putting out the real podcast. Anyway, let's go. Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Saturday, July 25th, 2026. It's just after 20:30 UTC, and it's just me. I'm Sam Minter, no Yvonne Bo today. And look, he's on vacation. He gave me plenty of heads up, like shortly after we recorded last week's show. He's like, next week I won't be here. On vacation. He's in the Bahamas, I believe. Actually, I think at this very moment while I'm recording, he's on the plane on the way back from the Bahamas. But judging from what he's been posting on the Curmudgeon's Corner Slack. But yeah, I send out the email that I usually send out asking for potential co-hosts and got no answers this time. As usual, I like didn't include the last couple of people to co-host. So like Ed and Bruce, who are usually up for it like a bunch of the time, weren't included in my invite because I try to like rotate and have some new people, but nobody else answered me, so it's just me. And also I was fairly constrained on my schedule, and I said like the only time I could really do it was Saturday morning Pacific time, and because I couldn't do it Friday, I had stuff going on, and Saturday afternoon I'm supposed to be out doing signs for my wife's campaign. It's getting close to her primary, so I promised her like 4 hours on Saturday, 4 hours on Sunday for the next few weeks. And yeah, that didn't work out, at least not so far, because I knew I didn't have a co-host. So I slept in. Well, I slept in for a couple reasons. One was I stayed up all night. I was working on some Robin Letter stuff. And I didn't really get started on the Robin Letter stuff till almost midnight. So I just kept powering through and I got to, a stopping point. I didn't actually finish the thing I was working on entirely, but I got to a reasonable stopping point, but not till like 6 a.m. So I went to sleep at 6 a.m. And then around 9:30, my wife calls me, my wife Brandy, because she had gone out to do doorbelling and such, but realized that she'd forgot her wallet at home and she wanted to like get a coffee or whatever. And she didn't have her wallet and she's going to something else later in the day where, she'd need to spend money. And so she's like, can you bring me my wallet? And of course I'm like, yes, I'll bring you my wallet. No, I'll bring you your wallet. What, you know what I mean? But I was, of course, I'd only like slept like 3 hours or something at this point. So I'm tired. I get up. And at first I'm like, I'm going to record the beginning of the podcast. Then I'll go bring you your wallet. And then I'll like go to a coffee shop and I'll prepare for like the signs and all the other stuff. But Alex was like, no, can you like come back to do the preparing for the signs? So that you leave the computer, because he's been using my computer, because his computer that he's actually using right now at this very second is old. So he tends to borrow my laptop or my wife's laptop instead these days. And he's got various projects he's working on him. Anyway, so I'm like, fine, I'll do that. I'll just go first to deliver this to your mom, and then I'll come back and I'll do all the stuff I need to do at home, and then I'll do signs. So I went, I'm like, okay, I will locate Brandy and then aim the GPS at her location. And I knew she'd be moving around because she was like going around knocking on doors, but I'm like, I'll go to where she is now and then I'll relocate her and she'll be close to where she was, and then I'll relocate again and find her after like two or three steps, right? So first of all, she's in like where she was doorbelling is off at one of the parts of her district that is the furthest from our house. I'm like, okay, fine, no problem. And so I head there and it's like a half hour to get there anyway. At one point, like I'm almost at the spot where it says she is, and I make a wrong turn. Well, specifically, I'm looking at the GPS, and I know I need to take the next left. And this brings me to something that, by the way, because I was go to where my wife is, and I'm using Apple's ecosystem and Find My and all that, I usually use Waze. But because there's like one click to go to where somebody you've located in Find My and just route to them in Apple Maps, I was using Apple Maps this time. And there's, both Apple Maps and Google Maps have bugged me for a long time. And I've explained it one way, which today I've realized was wrong. Okay, I've said for a long time, like when I'm using both Apple Maps and Google Maps, I get frustrated because it seems to lag your actual position by like half a second or something. So like compared to Waze, which was like always like snap on, this is where I am right now. And you could see when you were like approaching a turn and know exactly. And like it made perfect sense, right? And I was always frustrated because it seemed like Apple Maps and Google Maps, there seemed to be a lag. Notice I keep saying seemed to be. If you asked me before today, I would say there was a lag. Okay. But, so what it would always... Because I'm always sort of keeping an eye on the map and judging when to turn by seeing myself come up on the turn on the map, right? And so I would always be frustrated by doing this on both Google Maps and Apple Maps because it always seemed like I was further away from the turn than I actually was. Whereas on Waze, it would always match up exactly with my expectations and I'd turn right as I was approaching the turn, and et cetera. And so like I'd missed turns a variety of times when using Google Maps or Apple Maps because of this, because I'm like, it's lagging. And like, I sort of was trying to change my mindset to like, whenever I'm using one of those, be like, okay, remember, it lags a little bit, so you have to turn before you think the turn is, because it always looks like there's more space left before the turn on the map than there really is. Today, after I missed this turn, I realized this yesterday, but it still got me today anyway, because I'm still not used to it. I realized this while navigating somewhere yesterday, and then was thinking about it today while navigating, but still missed the turn. But look, I realized the problem is not it is lagging, because I very carefully watched the position while I was approaching a turn. It was showing me exactly where I was, but it was zooming in more aggressively than Waze does. So what happened basically is as you are approaching the actual turn, it is zooming in on the map to show you details of that turn at such a rate that the physical distance on the screen between you and the turn actually stays the same. So it looks like you're not getting any closer to that turn. But in fact, you are getting closer to the turn. It's just simultaneously zooming in at the exact same rate. So it doesn't look like you're getting closer to the turn. And I realized what Waze does is it just doesn't zoom in quite as far. It also zooms in as you approach a turn, but it stops zooming in a little further away from the view of the intersection. And one reason behind this, to be fair, is Google Map and Apple Maps tend to give a detailed view of the intersection. Like you can see all the lanes, you can see the shape of the intersection, you can see where the turn lanes are and where the regular lanes are. Whereas Waze doesn't show that level of detail, even if you zoom in. And I actually like that level of detail that Apple Maps and Google Maps provide. And I'm like, I wish Waze had that. But because they have that level of detail available to show you, they zoom in further and zoom in longer. So as you are actually approaching the intersection, it is still zooming in, and it is zooming in at a rate that almost exactly matches. So it looks like you're not getting closer. And I'm sure this is something, if I used Google Maps or Apple Maps all the time, I would have gotten used to a long time ago, and it would be natural to me, and of course I would know where the turn was. But because I use Waze all the time, and Waze doesn't do that last little bit of zoom every time I use Apple Maps or Google Maps, I get thrown off by this. And even though on the drive over there, I was actively thinking about this issue and thinking about it and like, as I approached various intersections, looking at the map and confirming that my hypothesis was correct, and it was, as I approached this particular intersection close to where Brandy's location was, another car came the other direction, right at where the turn was, obscured the view of the turn because it was a small street, not a big street, and I drove right past it. And because I was out in a rural area at this point, as opposed to like a place where there's like streets every 5 feet, the route it gave me when it rerouted, it was like a big, like 2 mile loop just to get back to where I was a few seconds earlier. Now, I probably could have turned around in like somebody's driveway or something, but I did the 2 mile loop and it took extra time. And then I got to the spot where Brandy had been. And then now I was being stubborn because while this was going on, hold on. Alex is
making me look at something.
Oh. FNAF 2? Alex just successfully completed FNAF 2. He's very excited. Okay. What was I saying? Okay. While all this had been going on, I think even slightly before I missed the turn, Brandy had texted me, and because I had CarPlay on, it had read this out loud, so I knew this. She texted me, "I'm no longer there, but I've stopped moving," and she sent me an address to where her new location was. But I didn't pause to change the address. I was like, okay, I will stick with my plan. I will get to where she was, and then I will relocate to her next location, and then I'll go there, and presumably each one will be closer than the one before, and I will sort of zoom in on her, and I will find her. So I did that once I got to the place where she had been, and well, of course, she was like 20 minutes back in the direction I had just come from. So I'm like, okay, fine. If at the moment she had texted me that she was no longer there, I had stopped and put in the new address where she was, I would have been there like a long time ago. So, but I went to the new place, and I got to the new place after the 20 minutes or whatever. And it was, her car was there, but she was not. So I located her again, and she was like, you know, half a mile away down the street. So I found her and I picked her up. And then I, you know, she had been doorbelling and talking to people. And, you know, the whole thing, I was going to bring her wallet and her purse that she'd left at home. I gave her those, but then she's like, you know, she needed like a bio break. I'm like, so I offered to like drive her to the nearest gas station and then bring her back where she was. And so I did that. And, you know, and then after all this, I had to drive home, which was another half hour. And so by the time all this is done and I'm at home, now it's afternoon. It's no longer morning. I'm way behind. I'm doing this segment. And I've now talked for like 15 minutes or something on this segment. And I haven't even gotten to the two movies yet. I'm going to do the two movies in a second. And then, as usual, I will take a break. I will go do those signs. I'll do my sign prep stuff. I do a whole bunch of stuff on spreadsheets to figure out where I'm going and keep track of what I'm doing and all that kind of stuff. I'm going to do that. That'll take about an hour. Then I'll finally go out and start doing signs. And my target is 4 hours of signs today, 4 hours of signs tomorrow. And I think what I'm going to do is the first hour of the four is going to be checking signs I've already put out to see their status and adjust them if necessary, which, by the way, there have been a rash. I've got all kinds of reports in the last week, and I've seen a few myself of places where I put out signs where the signs have been removed or knocked down or defaced or whatever. And so I'm going to try to hit some of those, and then 3 hours of putting out new signs. That's the plan anyway. But it's so late at this point. I can definitely still get 4 hours in before dark, but it's getting closer. And then I've got more Robin Letter stuff I have to do, and the rest of the segments of this podcast, which I'll probably do tomorrow or whatever. But tomorrow's going to be busy too. Anyway, I'll do a couple movies now, and I'll do newsy stuff in the second half of the show. Maybe I'll plan for only two segments this time, not three. We'll see how it goes. Okay, movies. 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 Okay, you probably didn't need that. Okay, I got two movies this time. Number one, from 2012, Paranorman. Kids movie? Well, Wikipedia description, not the plot yet. I'll get to that in a second. A 2012 American independent stop-motion animated comedy horror film. Directed by blah, blah, blah. Stars blah, blah, blah. It is the first stop-motion film to use a 3D color printer to create character faces. In the film, I'll jump to the plot. First couple paragraphs of the plot, like I often do. In the small town of Blythe Hollow, Massachusetts, Norman Babcock is an 11-year-old outcast who speaks with the dead, including his late paternal grandmother and various ghosts in town. Almost no one believes him, and he is isolated emotionally from his family while being looked down upon by his own peers around the school. Neil Down, an overweight boy who is also bullied, finds in Norman a kindred spirit. After rehearsing a school play commemorating the town's execution of a witch 3 centuries ago, the boys are confronted by Norman's estranged and seemingly deranged great uncle, Mr. Pendergast, who tells Norman that he soon must take up his regular ritual to protect the town. Soon after this encounter, Mr. Pendergast dies of a heart attack. During the official performance of the school play, Norman has a nightmarish vision of the town's past, in which he is pursued through the woods by townsfolk on a witch hunt, embarrassing himself and leading to a heated argument with his paranoid father, Perry, who later grounds him. His mother, Sandra, tells him that his father's manner is stern because he is afraid for him. The next day, Norman sees Pendergast's spirit, who tells him that the ritual must be performed with a certain book before sundown that day, then makes him swear to complete the task. Pendergast's spirit is set free and crosses over. Norman is at first reluctant to go because he is scared, but his grandmother tells him it's all right, and it's all right to be scared, as long as he does not let it change who he is. Norman sets off to retrieve the book from Pendergast's house, having to take it from his corpse. ... Things progress. He has to do this. There's things with ghosts. There's things with town folks. All of this kind of stuff. I liked it. It was cute. I'll be honest, before I read that description, I'd forgotten what it was about. Like, I was like, Paranorman, what was that again? What was that? I'm not sure. But it all came back to me when I read the description here. And it was cute. It's just a fun little animated movie. Nothing too deep. Nothing too, like, unexpected or profound. But it was fun. I'm going to give it a thumbs up. Because you need those kinds of fun movies. Not everything has to be, you know, deep and profound, Oscar-winning, best movie of all time stuff. It's nice. Let's see, what was its, anything about its reception and blah, blah, blah. They usually have that. Rotten Tomatoes, 89%. Average rating, 7.3 out of 10. Critical consensus, beautifully animated and solidly scripted. Paranorman will entertain and frighten older children while providing surprisingly thoughtful fare for their parents. Okay. Yeah, I liked it. Thumbs up. Good job. Speaking of movies that do get amazing critical acclaim and all that, my next movie is number one on the 1998 AFI 100 Years, 100 Movies list, Citizen Kane from 1941, which I actually did talk about close to the time that I actually saw it. One of the times Emily joined us on the show. And I mentioned that by complete coincidence, you know, when it was next in line, we'd actually watched number two, Casablanca. And then I happened to look online and discovered that, like, the very next day, Citizen Kane was actually playing in the theaters in our town as part of a series, like, I forget which chain does it, but there's a... Every summer, like, there's a chain that every weekend plays old classic movies. You can go see them. Anyway, it just happened by pure coincidence that it was that day for Citizen Kane. So we went and saw it in the actual theater. And so when I talked with Emily about this a few weeks back, not a few weeks, it was a lot longer ago than that at this point, last year sometime, it was fine. I liked it. I enjoyed it. I do not, however, feel like it really earns the number one slot. I think a lot of it is, you know, is that it was a pioneer and it used a lot of filmmaking techniques for the first time, and it was sort of radical for its time, and you see a lot of tropes and a lot of camera work styles and all kinds of things that later became, you know, standard fare in movies. And this was like the first big production to do a lot of these stuff, these things. And, you know, and it is sort of an epic and had a bunch of scale to it. And that was all fine. But, you know, I felt like when actually watching it, it's sort of slow. It's a little bit dry. I was spoiled as to the main sort of mystery, like, what is Rosebud? I'd never seen the movie in its entirety before seeing it in the theaters with Alex back last year. But, you know, I knew the main beats of it just from being around. Speaking of the main beats of it, I should read the plot summary from Wikipedia. Here's the beginning of it. In a mansion called Xanadu, part of a vast palatial estate in Florida, the elderly Charles Foster Kane is on his deathbed. Holding a snow globe, he He utters his last word, Rosebud, and dies. A newsreel obituary tells the life story of Kane, an enormously wealthy newspaper publisher and industry magnate. Kane's death becomes sensational news around the world, and the newsreel's producer tasks reporter Jerry Thompson with discovering the meaning of Rosebud. Thompson sets out to interview Kane's friends and associates. He tries to approach Kane's second wife, Susan Alexander Kane, now an alcoholic nightclub owner, but she refuses to talk to him. Thompson goes to the private archive of the late banker Walter Parks Thatcher. Through Thatcher's written memoirs, Thompson learns about Kane's rise from a Colorado boarding house and the decline of his fortune. Couple more paragraphs here. In 1871, gold was discovered through a mining deed belonging to Kane's mother, Mary Kane. She hired Thatcher to establish a trust that would provide for Kane's education and assume guardianship of him, protecting him from his brutal father. While the parents and Thatcher discussed arrangements inside the boarding house, the young Kane played happily with a sled in the snow outside. When his parents introduced him to Thatcher and told him he would live with him, the boy struck Thatcher with his sled and attempted to run away. By the time Kane gained control of his trust at the age of 25, the mine's productivity and Thatcher's prudent investing had made Kane one of the richest men in the world. Kane took control of the New York Inquirer newspaper and embarked on a career of yellow journalism, publishing scandalous articles that attacked Thatcher's and his own business interests. Kane sold his newspaper empire to Thatcher after the 1929 stock market crash left him short of cash. It continues. You sort of follow through Kane's life, and he has various ups and downs, various, you know, romantic entanglements, various business entanglements, various other things, and it goes through. And, and famously, Charles Foster Kane in this movie is intended to be mainly William Randolph Hearst, but also apparently a composite with Joseph Pulitzer as well, and perhaps a little bit of a couple other folks. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page. Chicago tycoons Samuel Insull and Harold McCormick as well as some aspects of the screenwriter's life. So it's a composite character of a bunch of people, but famously, it's William Randolph Hearst, okay, mostly. And then, you know, it's obviously fictionalized. It's not really William Randolph Hearst's biography, but it's, you know, intended to sort of be like that. And again, the movie did keep my attention, and I wanted to know what was going on, and I wanted to know what was happening next with the guy, because, you know, I mentioned I kind of knew the main plot beats, but at a super high level, I knew it was a William Randolph Hearst type story, and I knew what Rosebud was, but I really didn't know any of the details in between at all. And so it was interesting to see all that. But, you know, again, I'm not saying it wasn't a good movie. It was a good movie. It probably deserves to be in this top 100 list. But I think at number one, it's overrated. Like, I've said before, when I talked about Casablanca a few weeks ago, I would rate Casablanca higher than this movie. Like, if I had to pick a movie to rewatch, like, and I don't rewatch movies all that often, but I'm ready. I would watch Casablanca again. Casablanca was a cool movie to watch. It gripped me from beginning to end, and it left me, like, you know, emotional as it ended and all that kind of stuff. Citizen Kane was, it was more an academic exercise to watch it, you know, and it was interesting in that sense, but it wasn't like, I don't know. Like I said, it's probably a top 100 movie. I'm not sure it's even top 10, let alone number one. You know, there are a bunch of these others are a bunch of the others in the top 100 that I went through, which took me like 30 years to get through this stupid AFI top 100 list, by the way. But I did it, and Alex and I have now restarted it and are working with the 2007 revision of it. And as of this moment, let's see, we're back up to, where are we back up to? Ba 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 ba. Then we've watched 100 all the way to 71 already. Our next movie is going to be number 70 on the revised 2007 list. And there are a bunch of good movies on this top 100 list. And I would probably put a decent number of them above Citizen Kane. Maybe I'd put Citizen Kane at, like, I don't know, 50 or 60 or somewhere. Not number one. It's I think it's only number one because of the, you know, they give, like, the criteria that this is judged for. You know, first of all, it's just the length to qualify, length, and has to be English language, American, etc. Has to have critical recognition, major award winner, popularity over time, historical significance, cultural impact. I think this is here because of historical significance and maybe cultural impact. As a just what is the experience of watching it today? I don't think it's number one. Okay, that's it. I'm moving on. It is time for a break. I'm going to play the break, and then I'm going to go off and do all those signs and all that other stuff, and I'll record more tomorrow morning or something. Who knows? But this break is an Apple Dream. It is Apple Dream 5, which has appeared on the podcast before, so it's not a new one. But it's probably been a long, long time since it was played. So anyway, here is the break, which is Apple Dream 5, and back after this. And when we get back, we'll talk about actual, like, newsy stuff. And, you know, at the moment, I don't know, we got some Mitch McConnell stuff. We got, there's a new prime minister in the UK. We got, what else? We got Donald Trump talking about communism a lot. He was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. We got the price of oil going back up again. We got a bunch of stuff. I don't know which of them I'll talk about. I'll figure that out when I get back. And who knows? There may be new breaking news that I'm not even aware of now because it hasn't happened yet. Anyway, here's that Apple Dream, Apple Dream 5. Enjoy.
I was at a booth and there was this guy who was, there's stuff, but he couldn't do it. Programs that did programs that wrote programs and modified programs and stuff, but he couldn't do it properly for iTunes because it couldn't support old versions of the iPhone properly. It could do new versions, but not old versions. And I was going to talk to him about making something that worked with the new versions only, but he was scowling at me. And somehow we were all there at this sort of exhibition thing. And the person whose physics girl from YouTube was there giving a speech or something. And the person I was with said, she's like you, but for something. It wasn't physics, though. And I was like, well, not really. But that was before the part with the guy with the phone. And there was more before that, but I don't really remember stuff before that anymore. And there were people with me, I think including you, but I don't know. Bye.
Okay, I'm back. As expected, it's much later. It's the next day. It's July 26th, just after 19 UTC. So what I'm going to do, I just have like a handful of items on my list here, and I'm just going to lightning round them because I don't think any one of them is like a whole segment. Oh, putting out signs yesterday went fine. It's good. I did the whole 4 hours. 4 hours in Mill Creek this time, Mill Creek, Washington. Mill Creek, by the way, of all the areas in my wife's district, is the most hostile to signs, meaning like of all of the intersections of interest, there are a bunch that are in sort of areas that are managed by homeowners associations that just will not accept signs. Like if you put one out, it'll be gone instantly. And so I know not to try anymore in those areas. They're just not allowed. And so you basically all of the signs are on the two major streets on one side or the other, but everything in between is nothing. Don't even think about it. Don't even think about it. And it's just, and Mill Creek of the areas is also like fairly, like, I don't know. It's more compact, and it's so like, you know, for like some of the, whenever I go out to do a round of signs, I pick one of the towns, and I use towns generously because it means it's not like legal entity necessarily. It's like what's their postal address? Like the four big ones that have presence in my wife's district are Everett, Mill Creek, Bothell, and Snohomish. And Mill Creek is the smallest geographically. I guess Everett's because my wife's district doesn't have all of Everett. It has a little slice of it. That's probably not that much. It feels bigger than the Mill Creek one, but I don't think it actually is. It's probably actually smaller. But anyway, the Mill Creek one is compact. So I'm zipping around between signs and not going very far in between them. Whereas, like, for instance, the Snohomish one includes not just the town of Snohomish itself, but basically the entire part of my wife's district that isn't in one of those other towns. So it's got a huge amount of distance north to south, and huge portions of it are rural or semi-rural. So like as I'm going between like target intersections to put signs out, you know, I've got like a bunch of driving in between. I'm driving all over the place. It's scenic, and there's like pretty woods and pretty things. And like, whereas, you know, I don't know. And nothing against Mill Creek. Mill Creek is fine. But it's a relatively compact residential primarily area. So there's not as much to see. I mean, there are some cool looking houses. It's a relatively well-off area, most of it. Anyway, it went well. I always pick, like, I have this spreadsheet and I like rank the intersections I want to target. And like, I re-rank it before each round and what's the highest ranking intersection I haven't done yet. And then I will do the entire 4 hours that I'm out in one town rather than going back and forth all around everything. Cause that lets you be a little bit more efficient. Snohomish is still a little bit less efficient because it's so big. So I end up going from north, south, east, west, up, down. And yes, I know, you know, I could theoretically map out all the intersections I want to hit and like do a traveling salesman problem kind of thing on it. I do have them, but I have them sorted by priority, like, which for me corresponds roughly to population density. So like I hit the, so I am going, bopping up and down, left and right, you know, rather than going in sort of map order. Within sort of tide priority, I am sort of going roughly north to south, but roughly, not entirely. Anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. I have a few little things, but nothing that seemed like it was worth a whole segment. So let's just lightning round them and go like through and doodle gig boo boo. Yeah, that. Why isn't that? Okay. First of all, UK has a new prime minister, Burnham. He seems to be taking a play from Mamdani's playbook. And in the first few days, I guess it's fairly common, but like it like Trump did it too, actually. Like, it's sort of just try to start out by making some immediate changes to sort of please the base. From what I understand, he has caused a little bit of strife by immediately, like, you know, getting rid of a whole bunch of the cabinet that were loyalists to the old prime minister. And people are like, you didn't have to get rid of all of us. You could have kept some of us. And apparently there's some hard feelings. But I mean, come on, what do you expect? I mean, this is a normal pattern everywhere for leaders. They bring in their new team, their own team when they start up. We're only a few days in. I don't have a lot more to say about it. I don't know anything particularly insightful. I just thought it was worth noting, you know, and we still have the Count Benface election coming up. We'll see how that goes. Maybe someday he'll be prime minister. That'd be interesting, right? Okay, next up. See, that was quick. Lightning round. Like, I didn't have like 10, 15 minutes of stuff to say on that. I was just sort of noting it in passing almost, right? Okay, next up. Trump has been talking a lot in the last few days about communism. The last few weeks, I guess. Since Democratic Socialists won a bunch of races and primaries in New York a little while ago, and the Democratic Party sort of centrists have been freaking out a little bit about them winning, and oh no, they're going to be the face of the party, and that's going to doom us because the Republicans are going to like treat, you know, competitive centrist Democrats are going to have a hard time winning in purple states because these far left socialists are winning in deep blue states where they don't have to worry about Republicans, and the Republicans are just going to hang this on all of us, and it's going to be a problem. So, of course, Donald Trump is obliging and going to try to do that. But, of course, he's ham-fisted about it. So he's talking communism. It's like the 1950s Red Scare he's trying to bring back up. And it seems to, I don't know if it's resonating with his own folks, but from someone from my perspective, it's just dumb. I mean, any sort of threat of global international communism left a long, long time ago. I mean, even like, look, the Chinese still call themselves communist, but they're like as capitalist as you could be, you know? Like from an economic point of view, now they're authoritarians. They are, you know, the whole idea, this is not a democracy, but from an economic point of view, they're all about like, hey, let's make some money. Well, like that also changed like decades ago, right? You know? And look, the DSA folks, I think they actually do themselves a disservice by calling themselves that because of the baggage around the name. And I know they're trying to associate themselves with European Democratic Socialists and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, there's baggage around the name. They could call themselves something else and do fine. I mean, people point out, like, if you go position by position by position, many of their positions are wildly popular. You know, but the name is somewhat toxic in certain circles. And if so if you are after actually like winning over people, getting them to vote for you and all this kind of stuff, there's some branding issues at play here too. But, you know, and that's actually one thing that sort of wing of the party seems to also just have trouble with in general. They sort of feel like, well, we're obviously right. So everybody should just come to us and, you know, there's no need to compromise. There's no need to change our messaging to be more convincing. We can have our sort of little purity wars and, you know, anybody like even moderately like making overtures to even the center of the Democratic Party, let alone the center of American society, you know, needs to be kicked out because they're not pure. They have issues with this stuff. But I mean, even so, the, oh my God, there are a bunch of communists falls flat. Because what do people actually see? I mean, yeah, Mamdani is a perfect example here. Like, there was all this scaremongering before he was elected about how he would destroy New York, etc. So far, people seem to be thrilled. He's doing almost every day, you hear about small little changes that just improve people's lives. The most recent one I heard was simply like, he eliminated some of the licensing requirements or simplified them for people selling ice cream. Okay. You know, just make that process a little bit easier, streamlined. I'm presuming, I haven't read much past the headline, I'm presuming he's not letting people off the hook for like important health standards and things like that, you know. But, you know, getting rid of bureaucracy, streamlining things. He's doing some budget conscious things. People always try to hang the socialists and democratic socialists and all these folks with, you know, how much they're going to spend and blah, blah, blah. Regardless of the fact of, you know, how much are we spending in Iran? How many social programs could you get for those same dollars? Whatever. Anyway, it's a matter of prioritization, not about spend. But the whole communism thing just makes him seem out of touch. You know, we're not talking about communism. We're not even talking about pure socialism. We're talking about a brand of politics that simply says, yes, we should use government resources to help people. That's really the bottom line, and that it's important to do that and okay to do that, and it's fine for the government to spend its resources that way. And, you know, people who look at it point out, like, by the programs they're talking about are like, you know, the things FDR did. You know, it's not alien to American politics. It's just been a while. You know, and I think the people who like call them progressives are a little bit better off than the ones that call themselves democratic socialists for a branding point of view, even though the positions aren't all that much different. But also, you know, I've said this thing before, it's not really about policy. Like, you know, when Donald Trump is trying to brand them as communists, it's not because he's looking at a specific set of things they want to do that he's going to argue policy about. No, I mean, really? No. It is 100% branding. It is 100%. A lot of people have a negative, visceral reaction to this name, so he's going to attach the name to them. End of story. Where, again, if you start talking policy by policy, there's a lot of support for these things. Not universal, not everywhere. But it's not about policy. It's never about policy. And this is something that, well, I'm talking myself out of my own point as I talk. For the general population voting, it is almost never about policy. It is about vibes. And do you resonate with the particular candidate? And how do they make you feel? And that's frankly the secret to Donald Trump's success. But elites, to use a loaded term, care about policy. You know, if you are, you know, one of the billionaires putting money to influence politics, you care about that because you want specific policies enacted that will help you personally and others in your situation. And there are a lot of policy issues that matter to specific activists. If you are in a group that is currently getting screwed by the government or by society at large, then you care about policies that affect that group. And you know that, and that's why you have activists who really deeply care about issue one or issue two or issue three. But for the general populace, for winning elections, it's about vibes. And on the Democratic side, and I know I've said this before, and I'm going to probably say it like dozens more times before I'm done, but right now, the divide is not about policy. It is not about the left of the party versus the center of the party. That is not the real divide. Although it partially is lining up that way, but no, it's about attitude and approach and aggressiveness and whether you seem authentic, to use the word that was always used about Donald Trump as well. Like and frankly, the reason why there's so much excitement about the left in the Democratic Party right now is not their policies. And I think one of the mistakes that the people in the left make is they think it is about their policies. You know, they think everybody's getting so excited about policy A, B, or C. But no, it's about the fact that they seem like they authentically believe in those things. It's about the fact that they seem like they're willing to fight about those things. It's about the fact they seem willing to be aggressive about it. And, you know, I sometimes get frustrated at the no compromise aspect of them, but that's honest. It is part of their appeal as well. It hurts them as well. There's a balance that has to be done there. But that's part of the appeal they have and why young folks are excited about them, et cetera, because they see, you know, the folks who have been there a long time. I'm not going to say establishment. I'm not going to say, you know, the Jaredocracy. Oh, I just did. But the people who've been there a long time fundamentally are, you know, grew up in a pre-Trump world, started their politics in a world, even pre-Clinton in some of these cases, where the idealized mode of operation is bipartisanship. And you work with the other side and you come up with some compromise that's not what either of you wanted fully, but it's something in between that would go through, and you can get it through with bipartisan support and get something and move things forward incrementally. And the thing is, that world is currently gone. And I think the appeal is for people who recognize that and are willing to just say, okay, look, when or if we get power, we're going to use it to the maximum extent possible and just push through our agenda. And, you know, and yet you can argue about what that agenda is, and people certainly do. And like I said, there are many people who do care about that. But I think for a huge portion of the public, what they see is just willingness to do something, ability to get something done versus get there and be a disappointment because you don't do the things you said you were going to do. And a big part of this is misunderstanding of the checks and balances in the American system. But look, Donald Trump has run roughshod over all of that. And so now the other side wants their turn to run roughshod over the same controls. And there's certainly ways in which that's unhealthy, but I've said before, one of the reasons to get rid of the filibuster is so that voters can actually get what they voted for and then judge it based on the results for the next election, as opposed to voting for something, not getting it because of checks and balances and the filibuster and all kinds of other stuff, and then voting those people out because they didn't deliver, which I think is an ongoing pattern in current American politics. Anyway, the communism thing specifically, it's like just another thing where Donald Trump looks like he is still can't get past the 1980s. And it seems even worse now than it was before. Like, as with everything, as he's aging and falling apart, it seems like his worst tendencies from a decade ago are just getting even worse. And this is part of it. I don't know. I don't think it's working. And I think, you know, the centrist Democrats have to come to terms with the left side of their party as well. And the left side has to come to terms with the centrists. The winning formula is the big tent. And understand that there's a position for everybody there. And there's the overall, as like Nicole Wallace says on her show, the pro-democracy forces, across the board, spanning from the AOCs and Mamdanis of the world all the way over to the Liz Cheneys of the world, and they will disagree on many, many things. And the right time to have that argument is after they win. And then they can have those internal battles. But you need to unify enough to undo, well, not even undo the damage, to stop the ongoing damage being caused by Trump folks. That's the starting point. I've said before, the time to actually repair all this, decades and decades. And also increasingly, I think another division is if you're trying to bring it back to how it was pre-Trump, like you're trying to get back to the world where we had, Obama versus Romney and you did have some cooperation, and you did have, the Ronald Reagan days going out for drinks with Tip O'Neill. If you're trying to get back to that stuff, if you're trying to, I think the Biden presidency proved through his loss at the end of the 4 years that return to normalcy won't cut it. His whole initial, I think he changed a little bit towards the end of his term, but his whole starting out position was, okay, that nightmare of Donald Trump is over. Let's get back to doing things normally the way we used to. And he had a few successes, more than I ever expected. But the fact that at the end of the day, the result was Donald Trump getting elected again, proves you weren't aggressive enough. You didn't do what you needed to do. You didn't, the look forward, not back stuff, no good. Needed to be more aggressive dealing with the crimes of the Trump administration. You needed to be more aggressive. I said at the time, court reform right away, make new states right away, eliminate the filibuster right away, super aggressive social stuff that people will see right away. Honestly, Biden did more than almost anybody else going back decades in terms of some of those things, but not enough. And I think that's still the divide here. There are still a bunch of Democrats who are like, let's get back to how it was. That's not the winning answer. Anyway, I went on that longer than I meant to. Next up, and by the way, by saying not going back, again, I'm not making policy statements. You can be left, you can be centrist, you can whatever. It's an attitude thing and an approach thing. You can argue about the specific policies later. That's not the point at all. Moving on. Mitch McConnell, he posted that one proof of life picture with a newspaper and all that, but we still haven't seen him since. And more interesting, here's my take, first of all, on what's going on. I do not believe he's dead. I don't think there's a conspiracy theory that said that, he really is dead. Honestly, I at this point, I don't think he's on life support either. I don't think it's quite that bad. But he's clearly not in shape to return to the Senate. And I honestly believe what Mitch McConnell put out in his initial statement, that of just reluctance to share private details publicly. He just doesn't feel that's necessary. And I think that, this is the simple answer, is that they're actually telling the truth. He's in rehab, he's recovering, but it's a slow process. And he doesn't want to release all the details. He doesn't want to be seen in that sort of condition. He doesn't want to show just how frail he was. And frankly, before this, even when you had pictures of him in the Senate hallways and stuff like that. He did not look good. He probably looks worse right now, you know? But I think fundamentally, look, there is not much that's going, absent some additional unexpected stuff, you know, there is not much really that is going to be happening in the Senate between now and the end of Mitch McConnell's term at the beginning of January. They have a couple bills that they're trying to pass, and, you know, some of them are contrary, whatever. There's not really all that much going on. Mitch McConnell is not up for going to that right now. So why doesn't he just resign? Well, I completely aside from anything about, oh, well, they'll have a special election and maybe this would happen or that would happen, blah, blah, blah. I don't think that's it. I think Mitch McConnell wants to get better enough that he can come and give a goodbye speech and end his Senate career in a dignified way that he feels is owed to him. He doesn't want to resign from hospital bed and never go again. He wants to come in, do his last appearance, whatever. And he's not in shape to do that yet. But he hopes that he will be before January 3rd. And so I really think that's the bottom line. And then I don't understand. Let's say there is something that's going to happen. Right now, the Republicans are down a vote. They still have the majority, but they have to like have near uniform discipline to get anything done, which is hard. You know, and Donald Trump wants to do the SAVE Act, and they don't have the votes, and they wouldn't have the votes even if Mitch McConnell was there, but they don't have the votes. And they want, they're pushing through an NDAA and stuff. It's tight. And they can't afford to lose anything. So they're always in that position. The people who want, people are yelling at Governor Beshear, why don't you just call a special election? Well, and many people point out, he doesn't have the authority to declare the seat open. He has the authority to schedule the special election if the seat is declared open. He doesn't have the authority to do it. There are also people saying even that special election thing, it violates the Kentucky Constitution. He should just appoint a replacement. That is an out-on-the-limb legal theory that would spend the entire time between now and the end of the term in court and probably not be resolved anyway. But here's the thing. And he would be required to put in a Republican anyway. And people say, well, just nominate a Democrat anyway and fight that in court too. Again, we're talking about a temporary seat for a couple of months. And the on it, like let's say there was a special election right away. It's Kentucky. The Republican is going to win. So what are you actually like trying to encourage? You're trying to encourage the Republicans to get their seat back a little bit sooner than they would otherwise? What's the point in that? Like if coming from a pure Democratic position, having Mitch McConnell still a senator, but unable to actually do his job, is actually your best possible position. So why are you trying to push something else that will probably get your Democratic governor of Kentucky impeached if he tried it? It doesn't make sense. Anyway. That's my view of that. Next up, I ran. It's just worth noting, we did like a week and a half of daily strikes. Donald Trump was bringing all kinds of additional forces into the theater because apparently he had actually given the order to escalate further, but then back down. Apparently, many of the military advisors were very loudly talking about how bad an idea this would be, specifically in terms of further depleting already depleted resources in terms of like available Patriot missiles, you know, available munitions of all kinds of sorts, that we've used enough of already that we're already running short and haven't been able to replace them yet because manufacturing things takes time. And the last update I saw before I started recording this session was that Iran has said, and Donald Trump not only called off the escalation, he apparently has called off more strikes. He's basically, we did strikes every day for like something like 12 or 13 days. I forget exactly how long it was. We've stopped. And the Iranians have said, we'll stop as long as you stop. So apparently we're back essentially to a ceasefire state again. We'll see how that goes. We'll see if shipping through the straits starts up again, even at the limited levels it was a few weeks ago, or not. We'll see if this lasts a few days or a few weeks. My prediction from weeks ago continues to stand that this will basically be in this sort of on-again, off-again stalemate situation, at least through the November elections. Yeah, honestly, we've had a little bit more up and down than I thought. I hadn't predicted the like 12 days of concentrated additional bombing or whatever, but you know, it's still sort of relatively low level back and forth. And I'm not trying to minimize it. Like, you know, Donald Trump has got criticism for calling the skirmishes, and you know, they're real people who have died, both Americans and of course the people we're bombing. I don't want to minimize it that way, but it is still at this, even the last 12 days of stuff, we're not all out. It was hitting a few things there, a few things over there. And, you know, and Iran would occasionally hit something and we'd hit back, vice versa. I think that's the general pattern that we're going to see. I don't think we'll have either a true situation where there's no conflict at all going on for the rest of the year, or that all-out war. It'll be this kind of thing, at least through the November elections. After that, who knows? And, you know, honestly, who knows at all? You know, there are lots of unpredictable characters involved in what's going on here. But, okay. The next thing is some AI stuff. I just figured I'd talk about briefly, and then we'll wrap up the show. So I will start with, there was an article a few days back, and I'm looking at a July 21st article from Wired, OpenAI models escaped containment and hacked Hugging Face. And it's just the one I have in front of me. There were, you know, dozens of articles in all the places you would normally expect them about this. When it first happened, the bottom line of what happened, and this is honestly, this is not the first time we've read an article like this. It's just the most recent. But OpenAI was testing some cybersecurity-focused models internally. Their newest GPT-5.6 Sol, plus another internal model that they haven't released, were in a testing sandbox. And by the way, just to be clear, one of the things they do, they're testing their ability to hack systems. And they specifically take off some of the safeguards, there you go, that are normally in place on their commercial products that you and I can access. That tell it, you know, if you tell it, you know, go hack AT&T and change my cell phone bill, it will say no. Okay. But In this case, because they're specifically testing those capabilities, they take away those safeguards, but they stick it in a sandbox where theoretically it can't get to the internet and it can't do any real damage, etc. Well, it found a way out of the sandbox. Basically, they, you know, took advantage of bugs in some of the software in the sandbox that were supposed to allow it to install software from outside, and so allowed a few little connections, but which were supposed to be super restricted to only the things it was supposed to be able to access. And it found bugs, some of which were unknown zero-day bugs. It exploited them. It built up a series of exploits to basically, through that hole that it found, end up with unrestricted access to the internet. And then they had challenged it with apparently a test that is a standard test used on a whole bunch of models. And it figured out that there's a site called Hugging Face that hosts all kinds of models, all kinds of open source models, and all kinds of test harnesses for them, and all kinds of things related to that ecosystem. And it figured out, hey, wait, they probably have the test I'm taking, and they probably have the answers to the test I'm taking. So not only did it escape at Sandbox, it then went to Hugging Face, it then went and hacked Hugging Face, looking for the answers to the test that they were giving it so that it could cheat and just give all the right answers to the test. You know, in the end, I find that this is amusing. On the other hand, you know, it just shows like these things are getting really powerful and they are going to cause damage. And one of the factors that's going to cause that, and another bit I wanted to talk about today, is that, you know, the open source, open weight models are closing the gap with the frontier models coming from OpenAI and Anthropic and all of these companies. I saw something a few weeks ago saying that the gap was down to just a few months. It had been like a year, year and a half. It's now back down to just a few months. And arguably, there's one open source model that was released last week. I believe it's Kimi. Is it Kimi? I forget. That apparently is benchmarking really close to the Fable model that Anthropic just dropped. So there's at least some argument that that gap may be close to zero at this point. And look, when you have, and that has all kinds of implications. One, of course, is that if the open models that aren't owned by specific big corporations who are at least supposedly spending huge amounts of time on security and making sure their things can't be used in bad ways, blah, 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 the open models aren't going to have those same level of protections. And even if they try to put them there, they're open. People can reverse engineer it and remove it, and then there will be a model that doesn't have those protections. And so we're getting into a world where, you know, whatever protections they're trying to put in place are going to be more and more futile. I mean, we had this whole thing with, you know, with Anthropic, like holding back the model for a while because it was too smart, it was too dangerous. And so they held it back for a while and put extra protections and blah, blah, blah. Well, even if it was still 3 months behind, yeah, you got open ones coming right up behind it that are going to have the same issues and won't have those controls. There'll always be someone out there who will be able to take the same kind of technology and do it without whatever protections are being built by company X, Y, or Z. You know, I've noticed several times in this podcast already, I've done that formulation, company X, Y, and Z, policy ABC, policy 1, 2, 3. You know, it's getting repetitive, like 1, 2, 3. Anyway, so you're going to have a protections issue, and you're going to have people using these for things you wish they weren't using them for. And, you know, if one of them is good enough to be able to hack, you know, all this stuff and be able to escape its confinements and blah, 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 well, others are going to be too. And there may be a genie in the bottle problem. Second, though, how close behind open models are is also going to potentially cause business model problems for the big companies doing this. Like, why would you pay $100 a month to Anthropic for a Claude plan or more if you're a big company using the API access and using it across your whole company? $100 a month is what I'm spending personally on it. I'll get into that in a second too. But, you know, but why would you do that if you could get almost as good, and in the future, perhaps just as good, from something that's free? Why wouldn't you take the free option? Now, nothing's ever free. You know, if you have to run it on your own hardware, you have to have more expensive hardware, or you have to pay for more resources in the cloud, or whatever. But it's a different model. It's a different way of structuring things. And some people have said, well, look, it's already the case that the model itself makes a lot less difference than the harness you put around the model that helps it know how to approach certain problems and how to interact with you, and, you know, what tools does it have accessible to it, and how does it, and that may well be the case too. But those are also things that have the potential of becoming commodified. But I think that might be harder. Like, you know, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. You know, they're still, but regardless, it changes, like, where is the value add and where is the thing that you charge for? And what is the gap between the paid options to the big AI companies versus free options or significantly cheaper options? And how does this change the economics of the whole thing? And just, I want to be absolutely clear. I'm not saying that the whole model of making money off these AI things is going to completely collapse. It may just have to change and adjust. And with AI itself changing so fast, well, that's going to have to change fast too. People are going to, you know, the situation now is not the situation it was 3 months ago, and the situation in 3 months will not be the same. And it seems like the pace is still accelerating. At some point, it may level off. I'm not sure I completely buy the, you know, the singularity hypothesis that it will increase exponentially, and then the AIs will be able to improve themselves, and then it'll go hyper-exponential, and next thing you know, you know, the AIs have taken over the entire world and everything is free and we have utopia, or we're all, you know, Matrix style sitting in vats being batteries for the AIs. I'm not sure I buy that, but it may still be growing for a while before it hits whatever plateau it's going to hit. I don't know. So the other story, related to that story that I'm going to give, and Alex is sitting right next to me because he's part of this story. Well, he's sitting next to me anyway, but he's part of this story. Anthropic recently released, I'm not even going to talk about Fable, but they released Opus 5. And that's like their new sort of the default coding model. Like, you can go down to Sonnet or others if you want. Fable is supposed to be really good for, like, long-term planning. Like, a lot of the advice I saw was let Fable do your planning and let Opus do your execution. Anyway, Opus 5 is supposed to be nearly as good as Fable 5 at some things, and it was just released. And so Alex piggybacks off my Anthropic account and is using it for a bunch of his projects. And one of the projects, he was running into an issue. And it was specifically, he's got a VR game, a horror VR game he's working on. And there was, you have a flashlight that you can move around and shine at things. And the lighting from the flashlight wasn't working quite right. There were shadows being cast where there weren't supposed to be shadows being cast, and the light was shining through solid objects in some cases, and it wasn't making sense. And he was working to try to figure that out. And so, and he had an Claude was all set up and connected to Unity and all this stuff to like, so that it could do the work. Anyway, I suggested, go ahead and try Opus 5. I think he might have already moved to Opus 5, but it did have a setting. And the older versions had this too. I think they changed it slightly, but the older versions had, you basically have a slider in effect. On the command line version, you know, it's command line. Do you want it on low, medium, high, extra, whatever? On the desktop version, it's actually a physical slider. Well, physical. It's on your screen. There's a slider. Anyway, he was asking about this problem. And he switched it to, and look, I pointed out he had the slider. This was my bad, I guess. Anyway, he bumped it up to the very highest setting. It's like ultra code or something. I had never tried that high. Like I do most of my work on medium. I've occasionally gone to high when it was stuck on something and making the same stupid mistake over and over again. I think maybe I tried like extra once. I'd never jacked it all the way up to the top ever. Anyway, he did that and asked it to solve the problem. And it went off and started thinking. And it went off and started exploring his code base. It started spawning separate agents to go look at different aspects of the problem. Next thing I looked, well, it had a little status thing that said there were, you know, four agents working or whatever. But then I noticed that if you click on that, those agents had in turn spawned other agents. There were like 100 agents spinning off, looking at various things. It had like, by the time I was looking at it, it had like consumed like 7 million tokens and was coming up fast on 8. Like it was spinning, and I even showed him how to like stop the thing where it asked you every single step for permission to do it and put it on auto. So it just started going. And this thing was running and running and running, and it had gone like an hour and a half. And then I noticed that, wait a second, it hit like, you know, Claude has, if you're on a Claude subscription plan, you have limits every 5 hours and you have limits every week. And it had hit the 5 hour limit. Now, way back when I had the $20 plan, when I was using it a lot less and first trying it out, I initially I didn't hit that, even the $20 limits, but then I started hitting them. And so I turned on a thing to use credits after the $20 was gone. And at first I had it capped. So that you, like, if you hit $20, you have your $20 a month plan, and then if you hit $20 of credits, it stops. But then I kept hitting that $20 limit. So I raised it to, like, $50. Then I raised it to $100. And then one time I raised it to $200. Then shortly after that, I'm like, wait, that doesn't make any sense. I'm on the $20 a month plan and just set my credit limit for, like, up to $200 of credits in use. Let's just go to the $100 plan. So I moved to the $100 plan. And honestly, I had never hit a limit again since then. And that's partially because, like, if I was, you know, I probably should at this point. I if I'm going to ever be serious about it, I should do Robin Letter full time. But I'm still not doing that. Like, I'm still, like, occasionally using, yeah, I'll use it a few hours at a time for one project or another, sometimes Robin Letter, sometimes my other projects, but I'm not like using it 8 hours a day, every day, anything like that. And so ever since I switched to the $100 a month Anthropic plan, I had not hit any of these limits. I'd forgotten that these limits existed. Anyway, by the time I looked, Alex had blown through my 5 hour limit for Claude usage. And so it had flipped over to the credits. And by the time I looked, he'd already spent $100. And because my limit was 200, it was like, you know, it wasn't stopping yet. It was still thinking. And I was like, okay, look, Alex. It spent 90 minutes thinking about your problem. I'm going to let it keep going. We will talk later about whether I charge your allowance back for this amount, but I will let it keep going and see what happens here. And this thing better solve your problem. You know, you've spent like $100 on this, and it needs to solve your problem. Anyway, about half an hour later, it finished. It's been about 2 hours thinking without reporting back any additional detail as all these agents spun out. And it came back, told Alex confidently that it had found the problem and how to fix it. And the solution it had come up with was something that Claude and Alex had discussed, tested, and determined was wrong right before he switched to the new model and increased the effort level to maximum. It basically just came back with the thing they'd already determined was wrong. And so the problem was not solved. A grand total, I believe it was $117 later. And multiple hours of thinking. So, I've turned off the automatic flip to credits if the usage is, like, used up. And I've given Alex guidance to please usually operate at medium. He has permission, if it is having problem with a specific hard problem, to switch to high or even max, but don't do that ultra code thing again. But also, if I sit down to use Claude and can't, because it has hit a limit because of his usage, then we're going to get him his own account, probably at the $20 level to start with. And if he needs more than that, he's paying for it himself from his allowance, and see where that goes. But anyway, in the end, I was amused by it. He spent like $120 worth of credits. It did not solve his problem. After thinking for hours and spinning up like 100 agents to look at things, only to tell him what they had already discussed and tried 10 minutes before that was kicked off. I think subsequently Alex has been continuing to work with Claude on that particular problem. So from his update, sounds like you're making progress, right? It's not completely solved yet, but there is progress. It is solved. He has solved the problem. But it was not the $120 of credits that solved the problem. It was his work at the regular level of effort, going back and forth with it later. So with that, it's time to close up. Thank you for everybody who is in the thingy and thing. Go to curmudgeon-corner.com. You can see our transcripts. You can see all the ways to contact us. I presume Yvonne will be back next week. And we can, you know, we'll be back to normal. In the meantime, also go to our Patreon, which is linked from curmudgeon-corner.com. Give us lots of money. You can pay for the Claude subscription. And then we'll mention you on the show. We'll ring a bell. We'll send you a postcard. We'll send you a mug. All those kinds of things at different levels. As I always say, at $2 a month or more, we'll invite you to the Curmudgeon's Corner Slack, where Yvonne and I and others are chatting throughout the week, sharing links, all of that kind of stuff. Oh, yeah, $2 a month or more, or just ask. And if we feel like it, we'll let you in. If we like you and feel like it, and are in the mood, we will let you in. Now, like I've done the last couple times, I'm going to get Slackbot, leaning on AI once again, to summarize what's been going on in the Slack over the last week. So let me type this. Okay, here we go. Typing to Slack. Give me a summary of the most interesting and enticing items or conversations in the Slack over the last week that would make a non-member want to join if I told them about it. Okay, let's see what Slackbot has to say about this. Let me search across your Slack for the most interesting conversations from the past week. Let me dig a bit deeper into some of the more active threads and check other channels too. Okay, here we go. It's still typing. I'm going to wait till it finished typing to read it to you. Okay, that's too much. Okay. I'm going to tell it. That's too much. Give me the top five you think are the best to share. Okay, here we go. Here are the top five I'd lead with. Number one, we just talked about this. The AI that escaped its own safety net to steal the answers. Bob's deadpan reaction makes it. Not only did it escaped because it wanted to steal the answers to the test it was taking. Genuinely fun and unsettling. Number two, Edwards EV/tariff deep dive. A well-argued take on how U.S. trade policy is accelerating EV adoption everywhere except America, while Norway hits 90% plus electric. Rare to see this level of analysis in a chat group. Number three, Trump rewrites the Saudi nuclear deal hours after signing it. The thread reaction, especially Edwards' line about no nation trusting the U.S. to negotiate treaties for decades, was sharp and sober. Number five, Bob's daughter moving to Sweden. A genuinely warm moment, tearful airport goodbye, and the discovery her espresso machine had never been backflushed in 2.5 years. Real life seeps in here, and that's what makes the group feel like more than just a news feed. There you go. Oh, and apparently Slackbot is telling me I only have three messages left in my preview, and I would have to pay for Slackbot after this. So you guys will not have to worry about Slackbot in much more. I've only got three left, and there's no way I'd pay for this. I'm sorry. Now, would I potentially think about using a connector to let the Claude I already pay for access the Curmudgeon's Corner Slack so I could ask Claude this? Maybe. But am I going to pay Slack for Slackbot? No, I'm not. So that's one of those business model things. Like, what would you pay for? What would you not? Like, basically, I would use this if I was already paying for it for another purpose. I would never spend money just for having Slackbot here. And, you know, it is their, like, their advertising, their business plus plan, which undoubtedly has all kinds of other things that I don't need and don't want. Yvonne's paying for the Slack anyway, by the way. Like, we were using free Slack for the Curmudgeon's Corner Slack for years and years and years, but then it started warning that our earliest archives would be deleted if we didn't pay. And so Yvonne's like, I'll pay. And so we are now paying for the Curmudgeon's Corner Slack. This is a certain number of dollars per month per active member or something like that. So, which is probably more than the $2 a month that I say you have to pay to get in that we don't actually make people pay. So yeah, we lose money on this damn podcast. Whatever. Anyway, it's fine. It's fine. We'll do it live. There's an old reference. Okay. We're done. Have a great week, everybody. I'm going to do more signs in a different neighborhood. I haven't done my prep work yet to determine which area of the district I'm going to today. I will do that after I say goodbye, and then later I will come back and put this together and put it out. We'll see. Last week, I didn't get it out till like Tuesday UTC. It'll probably be at least Monday. It will be at least Monday UTC. I wouldn't be shocked if it's Tuesday UTC again before this goes out. We'll see how it goes. Anyway, stay safe, have fun, have a great week. Goodbye. So this is Sam. It is now the next day. It is Monday, July 27th, just before 1930 UTC. And if you were paying close attention, which probably none of you were, but if you were paying close attention, you would have noticed that I left out number 4 of the Slackbot summary. I realized this shortly after I stopped recording. So for completeness, number 4, daily games competition, Wordle, MapTap on a 3D globe, Bloomberg quizzes, running trash talk. Jetski, what? Are you done? Are you done, Jetski? Jetski's not done. Now maybe Jetski's done. We're in the car at Alex's school, and somebody walked by in the parking lot. You know, anyway, Wordle, mapped out on a 3D globe, Bloomberg quizzes, running trash talk. It's the kind of low-stakes daily ritual that actually builds a community. And there you go. There's number 4 that I left out, plus some fun barking. Bye, folks.